Everyone, this is the Something Beautiful podcast. I'm Jonathan Blundell. We're so thankful that you've joined us again for another episode of the Something Beautiful podcast. Of course, for some of you, this may be your first time. We do appreciate you tuning in. However you found us, we're thankful that you joined us for the Something Beautiful podcast, where we tell stories of ordinary folks doing extraordinary things, and especially how their faith impacts that and how their faith intersects with what they're doing in their daily lives. So thanks for joining us. This week we do have another great episode. We have Charles Lee coming up. He is one of the co-founders of Just One, which I'm a part of with their Laundry Love initiative and some of the things that they're doing in the Dallas area. He co-founded that with Greg Russinger, who we had on late last year. You can find his interview in the podcast archives. He also heads up a number of different conferences that he's done. Recently, the Idea Camp coming up. He'll be doing Ideation, which is a conference based on a lot of social justice, and a lot of nonprofit NGOs will be focused on a lot of that. He'll talk more about that, of course, during our podcast. He's also leads New Hope, which is a faith community in the LA area that's focused on social justice. So, great interview with Charles. We appreciate him taking the time to chat with us. He is a very busy man, lots of things that he's doing, and so we definitely appreciate him sharing his story and some of the things and some of the passions that God has laid on his heart. So without further ado, let's turn it over and chat with Charles right here on the Something Beautiful podcast, Stories Worth Talking About. Well, ladies and gentlemen, on the phone with me today, Mr. Idea himself, Charles Lee, over in Ventura, California. Charles, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
Now, before
thanks for having me.
Sure, glad to have you on. We've been itching. You've been on our list for a while, so glad that we were able to make this connection. Now, before we begin, tell me just a little bit about who you are.
Yeah, well, my name is Charles, and I do a few things. I lead a church called New Hope. We have a campus here in Torrance, California, and the one in L.A. And then I also co-founded an organization called Just One. I believe you had Greg Russinger on before. Mm-hmm. I co-founded the organization with him. That focuses on poverty, orphans, and human trafficking. And then I also run a series of different conferences. I do a lot of consulting in the areas of ideas, social media, marketing, branding. So that's kind of a side passion that's becoming more and more what I'm doing. So
okay.
It's a little bit, you know, I guess I just can't stay focused. That's my problem.
Now, you're married with, is it two kids?
Yep, I have two kids. I have a six-year-old son named Jonathan, just like you, mm-hmm. and I have a two-year-old daughter named Alexis.
Okay, very good. Well, now, did you, I guess growing up, did you think, okay, I'm going to run conferences, you know, when I grow up, or pastor a church, or even run a nonprofit? Was that any type of anywhere in your mind's eye?
No, not really. I mean, both my parents, both before they got divorced and afterwards, have always been entrepreneurs, and so I always knew I wanted to do something that was, you know, creative in that sense, starting new work. Mm-hmm. But I had no idea that, you know, being a part of a ministry or being a part of the church was any part of that. I think the only consistency has been I love working on new projects, so that's always been in my track record of doing things and creating new things and then creating sustainability for it and then moving on to other projects. So that's been constant, but I had no idea I'd be doing what I'm doing today.
Okay. Now, you mentioned you weren't, you know, the church and ministry wasn't in your thought pattern at all. Was it, did you not grow up in the church, or was it just, you know?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I grew up in the church, but I, you know, got a little bit really, I guess, disillusioned, and I really didn't understand really what the purpose was mm-hmm. behind being a part of the church. And I mean, when I went into college, I think my life kind of turned for the worse. And so within a year and a half after college, I had dropped out. I was living in Hollywood, and my lifestyle was pretty bad. So, you know, for me, the church was just more of a symbol, I guess, for me, where, you know, people just practice their traditions, and it was just religious exercise, and I got a little bit, I guess, discouraged, or maybe it was an excuse for my own anger for other things that were not happening the way I expected in my life. But for me, the church was really full of hypocrites. I didn't understand what the message was. It was confusing. Didn't understand the way people lived within the walls versus outside the walls. So, and then, you know, I was at that age where I just wanted to explore other things. So everything from other religions to just flat out just, you know, like I said, just live in Hollywood and live my life. So I really got this real nasty taste in my mouth for the church. So I just kind of flipped on my intentional rebellion switch. So it wasn't just out of ignorance. I said, look, my life's not making sense. It's not where I want it to be. So I said, you know, forget all this and just went on and flat out. I knew there must be some God. So it wasn't out of, you know, I didn't know that there was a God. I just went for it, and I said, I'm just going to blatantly rebel against God. So, you know, it was that kind of thing. So that's where I ended up totally in a place of pretty much despair. Until it got pretty bad where my family actually sent me. I kind of hit a low point probably when I was 21. And they sent me to this, I don't remember where it is, but they sent me to Canada to a special camp.
For special children.
to get well. And I think that's when I, for the first time, you know, I heard some preacher talking about, it was a Christian thing. I think it was kind of a Protestant/Catholic kind of feel to it. And he just talked about God's amazing grace. And I said, there's no way, because, you know, like I said, I was rebelling on purpose, and I thought, there's no way that God would ever forgive someone like me for everything I've done up to that point in my life. And I just kind of sensed, and I don't know if it was God or just my own heart or mind speaking, but it was just kind of like, hey, try me. See how great my grace is. And so that's where I kind of said, okay, maybe I'm really overly self-centered, which I was, and maybe there, I need to explore this a little bit more intentionally. Maybe there are people out there that are not as hypocritical as the ones I saw in the church. And so there must be some people who are of great good. And so that's when I started reading people like Mother Teresa, people I could, you know, knew from a distance, I could respect, and people like Martin Luther King Jr. and others. And I realized there was a side of faith that really made sense. And a lot of that actually had to do with compassion and justice. And that's where I think my life kind of hit a, you know, corner. And then, during that stage, I just ended up in a Bible college because my old youth pastor said, hey, until you figure things out, why don't you go to a Bible college? And so I went for a couple of weeks, dropped out. And then I actually went back a year later. And in one of my classes, I just fell in love with just really the clarity of thought as one of my professors, a couple of my professors, and I said, I want to do that. And so, you know, fast forward about 7 years from that point, I got my graduate degree and went back to my Bible college to be a professor, and that's where I taught for about 9 years, and that was last year.
Okay. Now was there, I know that a lot of people that turn their back on church, they say that there's kind of a repetitive pattern that they see, that, you know, it's not just one thing, but was there maybe a tipping point or one or two things that just kind of threw you over the edge?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there are moments where, you know, I just realized, like, I really asked myself this question, like, could faith, and this is really young, and, you know, like I mentioned, I was only 18, going, you know, between 18 and 21 when really kind of a dark season. I think I can't, you know, recall if it was more, it was probably more my issue than the actual church.
Okay.
I think the church was a good place to kind of catch your frustrations, my own frustrations on life. And so it became sort of like the venting place. So Were there legitimate concerns like hypocrisy? Most definitely. I didn't understand why churches would, people in the church would argue so much. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was a total turnoff. But then I also, you know, experienced, I was part of this one group that was fairly cultic, because I thought they would be more of the, you know, pure form of Christianity, which ended up being totally the opposite. And so I thought, man, this is a really militant group. The leader at that time, you know, he started, I didn't know much about the Bible at all, but he started making claims where he just sounded like he was a messianic figure of some kind. And I didn't know a lot, but I thought, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And so just, I'm like, man, people who look fervor really aren't, the ones I've met. And so I thought, you know, so it was just kind of a collection of moments around that time. And plus, I think the real one that kind of threw me off is my own life was a mess. And
okay.
So I think the church was a good excuse for my own life.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that to be true. I think when, you know, a lot of people are frustrated with the church, it's not, usually it's not just the church. It's probably something deeper. Like when someone decides to leave a church, it's probably rarely because of just the ministry that's happening at that church. There's probably layers, you know, complex layers of things that are going on in that person's life that leads them to feel like if they change their church, things would get better.
Mm.
So I feel like the angst that some carry towards the church is really not towards the church. I think it's more of a reflection of their own inner struggles about other things in life.
Mm-hmm.
So at least that's what I've seen in my own life, as well as people that I've talked to over the years that are frustrated with the church. I think there's something more than just the church. That's the problem.
That's a real interesting observation. Do you think that maybe, and maybe this is Western culture or just humanity in general, do you think that we've put undue expectations on the church then? That the church
totally,
is the fix-all?
Yeah, I totally think so. I think it's unrealistic. I mean, quite honestly, the way the church's its infrastructure, the way it's formatted, I think it's easy in that kind of organization to project perfection because we're supposed to be representing God's community, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a God who is perfect. So I think forgetting that really we're a collection of total misfits, a collection of individuals that really don't know what we're doing with our life.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of us can play it off better than others. That to expect that much from a organization led by, you know, human beings is totally unrealistic. And I think the struggle is the church represents the ideal or the perfection of God in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always going to fall short. It's always going to be frustrating. And so it's amazing. You know, it's kind of interesting that believers will lean so much on their local church to develop their faith.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I was in a conversation recently with somebody on our leadership, and he's like, it's kind of interesting that people will, you know, really be mature, and if they want to develop a skill or learn a profession, they go out of their ways to work hard. But when it comes to their own spirituality, it's as if you put it on a default system where you expect someone else to help you develop that, you know,
yeah.
In this case, the church and many of the areas of spirituality. So I feel like part of it's probably we create that environment where people feel the need to always have the church be the solution to their spiritual growth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's our struggle as a church is like, how do you allow people to be mature adults where they do work on their faith? And maybe the church can help create an environment where that can happen, but not necessarily create another program to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how that all works out, but I think there's something that it's unrealistic. The things we expect the church to do for our faith, I think that's a very, very impossible standard to reach for any group.
Right. Well, and I think it's interesting that you bring up the, you know, the expectations that are, I guess maybe the way that we form church, and I want to go back to this later, but Maybe we can touch on it now. The way that you've done Idea Camp is it's not one person telling their story and speaking to people all day long. It's multiple stories being told. It's people actually getting out there and sharing their own story. And I love that about what you're doing with Idea Camp, because I think the church should be more like that, that it's not just one person telling their story every week and every day. It's everybody getting up and sharing their experience. And I think if we did that, we might find some people taking a little bit more responsibility for their stories.
Yeah, and I think there's like probably wisdom. Like I often take like a Aristotelian perspective on virtue, and he talks a lot about wisdom is probably found, virtue is found in between two extremes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one extreme would be definitely to have that single monotone voice that leads the church. That can lead to either a cult or mm-hmm. it can lead to, more of a hierarchical dominance that can end up very unhealthy. The other thing is I don't necessarily, land on the other side where everybody has an egalitarian kind of voice. Mm-hmm. I think everybody has equal value and access, but I think it still needs to be somewhat guided by a group of leaders,
mm-hmm.
That works hard on facilitating the right kind of environment. I know in that book years ago, Unstoppable Force by Erwin McManus, he talked about pastors maybe should function more like cultural architects.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of creating just programs, creating an environment in which people can speak and can share and yet still have some boundaries and guidance of the conversation, that, I feel like that's where wisdom sits. Is that how do you allow people to feel that they do have a voice, and they actually do, without necessarily creating just an environment where nothing gets done because everyone's busy sharing their thoughts?
Right. Right.
So it's like in between the military structure that I think the church has adopted in, when it comes to efficiency of structure,
mm-hmm.
Along with, like what you guys are doing with this podcast, is how do you better tell the story of people within the framework of the overall mission of why the group exists. And so, I think leaders are the ones who can platform, give access to people telling their stories so that they can help them get to a place where everybody is closer to fulfilling the mission that God has given them.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay. Well, tell me a little bit about New Hope. How did that begin and how did you get started there?
Yeah, New Hope was a birth out of another church plant that started in the L.A. area. And that particular church plant, we started with about 100 people. And within, I think, 3 years, we had about 1,600 people there.
Mm-hmm.
It was really well-funded. We had phenomenal givers. We believe God gave us some great property in L.A. We got 23 acres of land pretty much handed to us.
Hmm.
So it was a massive, promote the church via billboard. I mean, talk about high production. It was that church. And we reached, thousands of people in a short period of time. And during that time, we were in friendship with Mosaic, Erwin McManus's ministry. And we thought of a way that we could partner because they didn't have space at the time. And we were going to offer them our Sunday morning slot, and that was kind of the church we were. We would just be overly generous to other groups. And so with them coming in, I thought, what a great opportunity to go plant another church. So I was co-pastoring that church. And I thought, okay, this might be really good where the other pastor would be there, and then I would go pastor another church. And I thought, in doing that, let's plant a church that is niche. In other words, we wanted to plant a church that had a specific focus on a passion of ours, which was compassion and justice.
Mm-hmm.
For me personally, I was just kind of at the stage in my life where I thought, man, I was spending 80% of my time on event production, and which has helped me running conferences. But I thought, I don't want to do that. I think that's the role of someone who leads a church. So I said, let's focus on a couple of things really well. And the thing that we really wanted to focus on was justice and compassion. That's really where my heart sits. And so I said, let's plant a church that does that well. Everything else we'll try to outsource. So we planted the church. And so what we do is we focus, we try to work really hard on becoming a church that cares for the world. And everything else, we try to outsource and participate with other groups. So if Mosaic has a great leadership conference, we'll just send our leaders there. If
okay.
another church locally has a great men's or women's get-together, we'll just ask our people to attend there. We don't have, like, recovery types of ministry, so we know churches that do that really well. And so we say, let's do our part really well, and let's support the overall kingdom. So
mm-hmm.
That's been kind of our posture. So we don't, you know, so we've brought about 20 people here, and we've kind of started, and we intentionally decided not to use some of the traditional marketing techniques we used before for the previous church.
Mm-hmm.
And that was effective at one level, but we just wanted, in some ways, slow, intentional growth. And so it's been kind of like that. You know, we'll be 4 years old in March, so it hasn't been that long. But it's been really great. I mean, we have two campuses. We don't have a ton of people, but each campus is just kind of contextually doing well in their own neighborhood. So the one in L.A. looks a lot different than the one here and more in the suburbs. So
okay.
kind of go back and forth from the campuses there.
Okay. So it's not necessarily a satellite type setup. It's,
no.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how are the how are the people
responding
to that, or that, you know, are people coming in saying, well, they don't have this program or that program, so I'm going to move on? Or
yeah,
get
a lot
excited?
Of people do. No, a lot of people do. I think they get inspired by our posture towards, you know, caring for the world. But a lot of them do end up in a place like if you have young family and we do have a, you know, great children's ministry now, but you know, initially we definitely had some of our struggles, so. A lot of families did leave. Some of them, it was too intense for them.
Mm-hmm.
For people who work in a nonprofit sector, they love it, you know?
Yeah.
They think it makes total sense. So, but we recognize that. So we kind of use a metaphor of an airport to describe our church, where basically our goal is not to retain the plane. Our
mm-hmm.
goal is to refresh and allow them to go where God's called them to go, and with blessing. And so we refer a lot to other churches because, you know, we're not here to compete with the church. We're trying to just play one small part in the overall movement of God's kingdom. So that's been our perspective, and it's been really good because then it totally disarms the note of, like, just competition with other churches. So other churches in the area actually like us,
mm-hmm.
which is, which is a good
that's
thing.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Well, then, since you've got kind of a different focus and so forth, is your Sunday morning gatherings or your weekly gatherings, are they built differently? Or are they planned differently?
You know what? Yeah, they're not.
Okay.
I mean, when people come visit, they're like, man, this just feels like a church. Exactly. The only real difference would be a lot of the messages have to do with loving people outside of the church.
Okay.
A lot of the stories and examples. Most, like I would say over 80% of our announcements have to do with opportunities of serving the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's different, but, you know, as far as format and style, I mean, both of our campuses have a cool environment, but for me, it's really the heart behind what we're doing. So, you know, we'll have, like, different kind of banners and stuff. We'll have quotes from Jesus, Mother Teresa, but then you'll see one from Gandhi, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's we're pretty, like, I think, conservative in our theology, but we feel like there's so much to be learned from people who work in areas of compassion.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really open to be formed by those others in faith as well as those outside of faith. Because in working with organizations, I've seen so many great organizations do what I believe the work of God. A lot of them just would never acknowledge it as such. But,
right.
You know, it's so important what they do for God's kingdom.
Right. Well, we didn't really touch on this with Greg, but maybe you can fill us in on kind of how y'all hooked up and how Just One really kicked off from there.
Yeah, we used to, Greg and I used to play music together. We used to, like, you know, we're part of the same denomination, so our denomination had put together a group of musicians from all over to play at it. different conferences and camps and stuff. So we just kind of I met that way. This was years ago.
So you weren't you weren't in his rockabilly band then?
No, no, Ruby Joe, no. but he was dressed like that. That was his style when I first met him. So we're totally like style and you know a lot of the specific interests we have. I think we're definitely different, but we shared you know hotel rooms and cabins at camps, and we really like years ago began to dream together about what the church can be. And one common thing we had was compassion, justice, caring for the world. And so Just One, Greg was doing a lot of the initiatives that are part of Just One right now in his community that he was leading up there in California. And I just kind of came alongside and said, hey, we need to kind of maybe make this a little bit more formal and, you know, bring some sustainability, reproducibility to some of the initiatives. So we launched Just One together. And so it's been good. I mean, he's up in Portland, as you know, and and so he's really like really the one who runs the day-to-day operations of Just One and continually creating things for Just One. And what I've done more of late is just, you know, my role has been more to get Just One exposure and onto new platforms and, you know, trying to promote some of his initiatives in other venues that may not have heard about it. So it's a really good friendship. And, you know, he's been a lifelong friend, it feels like. So we've probably known each other for more than 10 years.
Okay. So then... Yeah. Was it the ideas of Just One that kind of brought about New Hope, or was it just all the ideas of compassion?
Yeah, it was all kind of merged at the same time. I think, you know, Greg and I, timeline kind of crossed over when it comes to compassion. I know he was learning more things about what's happening. For me, about, I don't know, maybe a little bit over 7 years ago, my mother, who was doing business in China, she just called and said, hey, she fell in love with the street kids there. She started an orphanage.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there are other people in my life closer to home, if you will, that start to jump into these areas. And I thought, man, I need to kind of a little bit be more intentional about how compassion and justice affects faith. And which is really good because if I didn't dive into this area, I think I might have walked away because, you know, for me, one of the big questions was, could Jesus really practically, tangibly affect the condition of the world?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really understand how the activities of the church did that, at least in the churches that I was a part of. So for me, it was a lifesaver, you know.
Yeah.
And then rereading the gospel stories and seeing how much Jesus cared for those who, some of them didn't ever come to faith even, you know, but yet he just... with a really such an incredible degree of authenticity and purity, he just loved people. So, you know, it was kind of, I think the timing was just right and it just made sense that we start Just One together.
Okay. Well, and now maybe for some people that are listening, I know most of our listeners are kind of used to this idea of compassion and justice, but
right. But
some of them may not be. So what would you say, why is it important for Christians and for followers of Christ to be concerned about compassion? Why is it important that we're concerned about justice?
Yeah, I think if you look in a scripture, you know, when you see language of things like righteousness, and terms directly like justice, there seems to be this consistency in God's nature of God being just, that he wants to make things right. And then, you know, at the root of the concept of justice is to make things right. And so, you know, when you consider throughout Scripture that often God will refer to, for example, the marginalized, the poor. I mean, there's over 2,000 verses that talk about the poor. But there's also other passages that really, like, you know, it's kind of interesting, like, for example, in the Old Testament, when people end up in idolatry, God's response to them isn't like, you guys need to worship better, you know, have better church, if you will, from a New Testament perspective. Often his response is, you got to take care of your widows and the poor and the orphan. And it's kind of interesting that the response to idolatry is actually compassion and justice. And so, you know, for me, that kind of clicked And I realized God somehow wants to use his really ministry to the weak, if you will, the least, through the eyes of our culture. And through that kind of expresses his incredible love and who he is. And so for me, like, it's very foundational. Like, there's this passage in Jeremiah that talks about, you know, take care of the widow, the orphan. Is that not what it is to know me?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, you know, I think justice and compassion and being active in those words keeps me on my, keeps me centered on my understanding of Christ. Because I think when he says, I brought good news to the poor, I was so guilty of spiritualizing passages like that, you know, and not reading it for what it is. And that is, Jesus actually came and became good news to the poor, very
mm-hmm.
physically poor.
Right.
You know? And so, you know, for me, it's like, I think I made too much of the scriptures way too figurative and way too personalized. And, you know, I realized it was a narcissistic faith, and that Jesus' heart is that we would become expressions of his love to the world. And I think one of the best apologetics for it becoming that expression is loving the world.
Yeah.
And so it's really central to faith. It's not something you add on. And the more I study church history, I realize, you know, I had just belonged to a couple of streams of Christianity that disassociated themselves from compassion work. And so, but I realize there are other traditions that are still rooted, have been rooted in the works of compassion.
Mm-hmm.
Still, that mainline evangelicalism has disconnected itself to a large extent outside of what was known as like outreach or missions. But that component of compassion historically was a big part of the way that the church was birthed. And so, you know, I come from a Pentecostal charismatic background, and, you know, charismatics are busy highlighting, you know, Acts 2, the coming of the Holy Spirit. And
right.
And I think Greg once said this really well, and that is, you know, Acts 2, the first four verses are great, but it shouldn't lead to the last few verses of them sharing everything,
mm-hmm.
living in community. And, you know, so I feel like that's always been a part of it. And you look at church history, like the first couple of centuries of the percentage of budget allocated towards benevolence is ridiculous for the church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some areas as high as 90% of their budget given towards benevolence. And so that became a real challenge for us, even, you know, starting the churches. Until this year, we made it all volunteer, which allowed us to invest heavily in our cities, a lot of money.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that was all part of the understanding of compassion.
Gotcha. Well, what has the focus on compassion and justice done? You said that initially when you kind of came back to Christ, when you came back to faith, you said, I think your wording was, you know, God's amazing grace is what was attractive to you. What has compassion and justice taught you about that grace?
It's really offered to all without condition.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that I see it played out is, I think caring for people's physical needs is a part of that expression of grace without the need to kind of bring in the sales pitch, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the common thing was, you know, I grew up in the church that we would go feed the homeless, but, you know, they had to listen to the message first. And then afterwards, we all went to a nice restaurant to eat while we gave them leftovers from a food bank,
yeah.
You know?
Right.
And I thought, man, something is totally wrong. I think Jesus would have ate with them. I think he would have given them food without them having to listen in line, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm like, there's such a disconnect where we did the act supposedly of compassion, and then the act of justice is like, how do you make a situation like that right? And asking questions, more systemic questions. And I think this is an area that the church definitely needs to develop more overall, is it's not just giving somebody a Band-Aid, or, you know, filling their immediate needs only. It's like, how do you systemically change the environment that brings lasting change for their lives? And mm-hmm. so, you know, we always think, like, even in our church, if we commit to a project, we're thinking decades, not seasons of a campaign.
Right.
So, you know, I think those things are all, you know, a big part of it is like, how do we do that? How do we reconnect our faith and the way it's expressed to people in a way that brings change, and prayerfully that, you know, ultimately it will lead to a place where they get to know God. And the reality is many people we serve on the streets already know God, which is another interesting thing where I think I was guilty of thinking that I was the Messiah to bring the relief and the change to people.
Right.
You know, and when in actuality, I think all of us would agree that God's been working in our lives ever since we were conceived. And the you know question that I ask people all the time now is, why would you think that's not true of everybody else you meet on the streets?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's no longer bringing God to them. God's already there. The bigger question is, how will you listen to the God who's already working in your life? How will you hear their story?
Mm.
You know, are you able to identify the imprint of God's hand on their lives? And then figure out what is God doing, and then figure out what's the best way I can serve what God's doing in this individual's life. That's a totally different perspective than the one I was brought up in.
Right. Well, very good. Well, tell me a little bit. This past year, 2009, you had three idea camps.
Yeah.
All started back, I guess, early in the year. But tell me a little bit about how that process began and what birthed that.
Yeah, Idea Camp was just a simple idea. I mean, you know, I go to a lot of conferences, whether to speak or just to attend. And for me, I still think conferences have a lot of value. I mean, there was even when I was totally just kind of fed up with conferences. But I realized, you know, conferences were more about the networking and the meeting of people. And just to be along with other people who are kind of in your same shoes is always encouraging. So I thought, okay, how do we create a conference that actually does that part better, the encouragement, the mutual learning, than a conference where you go and sit and listen to someone that can totally inspire you? And I think there's times for that. But, you know, if you go to enough conferences, sometimes you hear the same talk from the same people because they have a set speech. And so I thought, you know, let's create an environment where it's kind of in between traditional conference. And then I was reading up a lot more on unconferences or pod camps. These are user-generated conferences where a group of people will show up and then self-organize into workshops and so forth. And I thought that's a fascinating concept in technology. And so I thought, okay, maybe we can't do that completely yet, but what if we do something in between? So I thought, let's create a conference where the focus is not these major speakers, but the focus is the actual people showing up. And so the way we formatted idea camps were like, there were no real presentations, except maybe one at the end. Mainly it's just interviews during the general sessions, and then during the workshops, which is where I think idea camp really happens, there would be a facilitator of a conversation that presents for only 5 to 10 minutes, and the rest of the time is supposed to be just that facilitation of conversation about a given topic.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing is most people have showed up to idea camps are practitioners in the field. So it's creating an environment where people can learn from their peers. I mean, that's the beauty of idea camp, and the network that takes place actually lasts. I mean, that's the amazing thing is if you trust people enough, they'll connect and keep working together. And that's been awesome to see, like, people, you know, working on business plans together, working nonprofit work together. Some of them have definitely, you know, some of them have been church leaders. Because I think most of the Idea Camp individuals aren't necessarily leaders of churches in a professional kind of way. They're just people in business, different backgrounds, and to see them work together is a beautiful thing. And I think most of them would say, hey, the thing I got out of Idea Camp the most is I met so-and-so. And so, you know, when you create a conference that's built upon that premise of connecting, people actually connect. So that's been the beauty of it. And we've had great speakers, but they're really not the focus. And they know they're not the primary focus. So we don't advertise, you know, you got to come because so-and-so is going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You got to come because other people just like you are going to be there that want to learn from one another and connect. So that's the beauty of Idea Camp.
Well, and I think what's great about it is because you have the online aspect of it as well, even someone like me who hasn't been able to attend physically, I've still been able to connect with folks around the country through the Idea Camp. You know, Jason Dukes and I have connected, Mike Rush and I have connected.
Awesome.
And it's just we've been able to – I mean, we haven't started any business by any means, but through the Idea Camp, we've connected and we've kept that flow going. And you can keep your – you know, I've got my Twitter search always set for Idea Camp, and so I'm always seeing the things that just continue to roll through even beyond the conference.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's really the part of it, and, you know, to just hear stories like that. And that's the way I'm kind of analyzing or, like, the criteria for success, if you will, for that endeavor is, are there ample stories of people who actually connected? And there are, so that's an amazing thing to be a part of. And And it's kind of become its own tribe, if you will, kind of using Seth Godin's language. It's become like that. So people are actually gathering together informally. When they travel, they connect with other Idea Campers at conferences, which is really, really interesting. And so people are doing their own meetups and so forth. And so, I mean, if Idea Camp were to end today, I'd be totally satisfied because it was initially just a plan for one conference that ended up being in three cities. So, 2009 was a great year for Idea Camp.
Very cool. Now, and then tell me a little bit about this upcoming year. You've got Idea Asian. Is it Idea?
I wanted to create a conference. I mean, we'll do Idea Camps. We'll do a couple of Idea Camps in this upcoming year. But I also wanted to do a conference that was a little bit different. I wanted to create a conference that was in between a conference and a group consultation. So, you know, I don't want to say it's the next step for Idea Camp. That really wasn't the goal. It's just a totally different format. This one will have keynote presentations. This one will have two-hour sessions with some of the thinkers, and they'll get to present more on what they're doing well in a given field. And then we're also bringing some great facilitators to do whiteboard sessions in smaller groups.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to cap the attendance at 400 people. So it won't be a big conference in any way. And then we also have created some ample opportunities for people to really connect with others in their own field. So it's a little bit more structured in the sense that, you know, it's not as self-organizing as Idea Camp, but we're trying to bring in like 10 to 12 some of the top thinkers in a given field. So the one we're going to do in April 5th and 6th out here in Long Beach will focus on humanitarian care and nonprofit work. So we'll have people like Scott Harrison and Started Charity Water. We have Ben Kesey, who is the CEO of Invisible Children. We have Beth Cantor, who is social media guru when it comes to nonprofit work. And she'll be around. We have so and Ideation is definitely not it's not a faith-based event.
Okay.
It just revolves around particular themes. So we'll have people of faith, those who are not. We have like Heath Call from World Vision. He's like the executive fund developer for their water projects.
Mm.
So people will come in, share their expertise on one aspect of running a nonprofit. And so it's a totally different kind of experience than Idea Camp. I know the names are kind of familiar, similar, but it's really meant to help the nonprofit world develop. And, you know, Ideation may do another conference. Some of the other topics we have coming up may be like one on entrepreneurialism, one on social media. So it's a little bit different. Idea Camp will still continue, like I said. We're partnering actually with a couple of great conferences coming up, like one in Florida called Exponential. But we're also going to do probably, you know, the one big Idea Camp we'll do this year will probably be in Vegas. That revolves around the topic of sex and sexuality. So that's the one big one that will kind of stand on its own legs. But I feel like Idea Camp could also be a benefit to other conferences, just the format to complement an existing conference as well. So,
okay.
Those are all things that are kind of developing right now.
Very good. Well, you've probably touched on this throughout our chat, but what would you say is the biggest change in your view of God from being a kid in L.A. to now pastoring your church and being involved in Just One, Idea Camp, and so forth?
Yeah, I think the biggest change is I realized that, you know, God really does desire to use everyday people to do some great things. So doing great things for God, I think, were kind of relegated to those who were leading churches. But I realized, you know, the beauty of the church is that we have to be diverse. I mean, we have to focus on different areas of just kind of life here on earth. And the big thing is, if we can figure out through God's help how to network those specialties, then real beautiful kingdom results will come to fruition. So for me, the biggest shift has been, you know, I need to rethink about the way I view people in the church.
Mm-hmm.
As a leader of a church, it's really not about them becoming more active just in our church. It's like, how do we help them get to a place where they can integrate their vocation with their faith, that they can integrate their family and faith, and their friendships with their neighbors? How do we live in such a way that, you know, God really does permeate all aspects of our life, and He wants to? And how do we make the business person feel as legitimate as the homemaker, as the plumber, when it comes to kingdom activity? I feel like that's been the biggest shift. And the biggest goal for our church is, how do we help people get there?
Very good.
How do we, help them professionally, personally, all of those different areas, live out the faith?
Okay. Good stuff. Well, any last comments or any suggestions for folks as we're wrapping up here?
No, I mean, just keep, I think, you know, instead of waiting for God to call you to an area, I feel like God's wisdom is found in motion. And
mm-hmm.
so keep moving and allow that to guide your faith.
Mm. So you mean we don't have to sit and wait for a couple years for God to show up and do something?
Exactly. He probably won't show up if you just sit and wait.
I just love the picture Mark Batterson talked about, and I can't remember, what, I think it was his second book, about the Israelites getting ready to cross the Jordan. And, you know, they had seen the waters part at the Red Sea, and so they had seen God move in front of them and move in that direction. But, you know, at this point, God says, no, you need to just move. And it wasn't until they actually stepped onto the water that the waters parted. And so
right.
it's sometimes like that. God just says, just keep moving and I'll work. You don't need to wait
right.
for the waters to part. I'll go ahead and take care of it once you get there.
Yeah. That's life, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, very good, Charles. Well, how can people reach you if they want to find out more about you or Idea Camp or some of the other projects that you're involved in?
Yeah, I think the most simple way is just kind of through my blog, which is just Charles, the letter T, Lee, LEE.com.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like my hub for all of my activities in life. So.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, we appreciate all that you're doing for the kingdom. We appreciate the inspiration that you're providing for people and the avenues that you're providing for people to network and to learn more about this idea of compassion and justice. So I appreciate all that you're doing out there.
Well, thanks, Jonathan, for the time. Appreciate the interview.
Let's go. It's Mr. Jay Medeiros and Booney Mayfield. You know, I got a little story to tell you about Columbia Ave. Listen up. There must have been about 1,000 pounds of housing found, drowning in the flood. The sound of trust of and counting down the hour, frowns the sun around and pounded of the blaze. The helicopters, baby, it a bomb and promenade. See it, the mamas want to save the drop upon us on the shades. A fear of honesty, a tear for harmony, alarm of me. A Honda beeps the lottery. I'm joking like they onto me. Cars play the martyr, broken windows say I'm starving, but they bar say don't bother. And I'm hollering these words, reciting Sarah Connor with the calling of the birds on bikes. Americanas, feed at night, it's marijuana. They light it on the corner. With his sidekick and a quarter for the phone and further orders. Could have grown before it caught up in the home where he was brought up. Shot till he dropped dormant. Then his property got bought up. Killed his metal in the streets for everybody they reported. Heard the devil in their sleep, said he would properly deport it. Come on.
You see, the world won't change. If the people don't move, we can't hide our faces. You know we got a lot to use. And they say that it just can't happen. But they like the heart to say. Oh, we've been wild.
my neighbor's Freemason on the stairs where we live. Should I wait for these Freemasons to take care of these kids? I hear the conversations. They the center of a nation. Replacing renters with owners is known as gentrification. The incentive is only for lenders. The vindication got more members for bartenders and mentors in education while the vendors selling their own clothes. I stop and listen. Couldn't tell if it was self-imposed. Spot a victim without a pot to piss in or without the thought to get one. It's a hard knocks living when the parking lots are sick. And you cover box to sit on. 100 blocks where rocks are given. 100 blocks where cops are hitting. On the chopper block ascending. Stop the clock for a minute. I breathe and drop my mop as a tenant. I leave the discoverer inquisitor to humble the path. I'm just another visitor on Columbia Ave.
You see, the world won't change. The world won't change if the people don't move. We can't hide our faces. You know we got a lot to use. And they say that it just can't happen, but they lack the heart to say. Oh, we put words to action.
You've been listening to Something Beautiful, part of the Emergent Podcast Network. For more information about this and other great shows, visit us online at www.emergentpodcast.com.
If you have any questions or comments about this show, we do encourage you to drop us a line. You can email us somethingbeautifulpodcast@gmail.com or call our listener line. 972-535-8980, 972-535-8980, or anywhere in the world if you're on Skype, simply Skype J.D. Blundell, and you can find a link to that right on our podcast page at www.somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.
Thanks for listening to the Something Beautiful podcast. Join us again next week at somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.